want to welcome everybody to the Scholar in Residence program and to this lecture that has been sponsored by Yeshiva University and the Center for the Jewish Future. I want to first take an opportunity to thank Rabbi Levi Mostovsky. For initiating this with us, for making the initial contact, and for literally hand-holding the process through from the YUN. I want to thank Ruthie Asher for the incredible number of hours, phone calls, effort, and energy that she put in together with her committee. We had a committee, the names were on the announcements yesterday. I don't have them in front of me. Thank them all yesterday in the announcements, but a special thanks to Ruthie really goes for all of the work that she did, so thank you. We are truly privileged to have Dr. Polkowitz with us. For any of you who were able to join us for Shabbos and to hear his presentations, know the depth of the scholarship and the charismatic and energetic way in which he is able to enlighten us and inspire us is truly remarkable. Dr. Polkowitz holds the Gwendolyn and Joseph Strauss Chair in Jewish Education at Yeshiva University's Azrieli Graduate School in Jewish Education and at its Stern College for Women. He teaches courses in pastoral psychology at the Reitz Smicha program, serves as a special assistant to the president of Yeshiva University. Before assuming his position on the faculty of YU, he was a clinical professor of psychology in psychiatry. I'm not sure what psychology in psychiatry means. At New York University School of Medicine and director of psychology at North Shore University Hospital, New York University School of Medicine, Dr. Polkowitz has published and lectured extensively on a variety of topics, including child and adolescent behavior problems. Adolescents don't have any behavior problems.
No. It's actually redundant.
Most recently, together with his father, he co-authored a book on parenting titled Balanced Parenting, Love and Limits in Raising Children. He is a scholar as well as a Talmud Chacham, and from a rabbinic family that is well known throughout the Jewish world for many years, and it's really a privilege for us to have Dr. Polkowitz in our midst and to be able to drink from the waters of his knowledge and experience that he shares with us. Thank you.
Okay, thank you everybody. Hello. One of my favorite topics to talk about, and it's a complex topic. It's one of the more complex ones. And recently I've done some research related to this that I'm going to share with you. But let me start by talking about one of the ingredients that nourishes spiritual development in children. I'm going to start with a quote, and that'll be the lead into the first ingredient that I'm talking about, which is time. Which will become clear, right? That spirituality and true internalized sense of religiousness is fostered through our relationship with our children through time. Listen to this quote. It says, and unfortunately, in my rush, I printed it out in a way that I can't give proper attribution to who wrote this, but it's beautiful. It's called Crashing Through the Woods. If we want to support each other's inner lives, we must remember a simple truth. The human soul does not want to be fixed. It wants simply to be seen and heard. If we want to see and hear a person's soul, there's another truth. We must remember, the soul is like a wild animal. Tough, resilient, and yet shy. When we go crashing through the woods, shouting for it to come out so we can help it, the soul will stay in hiding. But if we're willing to sit quietly and wait for a while, the soul may show itself. That's what nourishes children's spirituality. It's what happens when we're not even watching. It's what happens when we're just sitting with our children and they absorb our lessons and they see how we are in terms of our relationship with God. And we nourish it mostly by showing them that there's nothing more important to us than spending time with them. Let me start with a double vignette, okay? Vignette number one is a very brief vignette. My three-year-old grandson comes from Israel to visit with me in the summer. I brought my daughter and son-in-law along, but the main thing is my three-year-old grandson. I was very excited, okay? And I was all excited because I got to be a kid again. It had been a generation since I took my my youngest child to the park. I hadn't been in the park in a very long time. So Sunday morning, like now, and I take the poor kid, I don't think he wanted to go, I take him to the park. But he's learned to humor me. At his young age, he already knows I'm totally out of my mind, and he's certainly more mature than I am. And I take him to the park. Remember, I haven't been to a park in a generation. My youngest daughter's already, it's already getting there, getting close to a generation. So I get to the park, and the first thing I see, I was very excited, because what do I see? I see a bunch of fathers Sunday morning pushing their children on swings. And I think to myself, that's wonderful. Big change in the generations. Fathers are more actively involved. Last time I'd been in the park was only mothers, you know, and me, you know. And I go to take my grandson to the swing, and what I'm hit with is the real story. A Bluetooth in every ear. The Bluetooth in every ear. So the fathers are there, but they're not there. What's the message to the kids? Okay? What do the kids see reflected back in the eyes of their fathers when they get off the swing? What do they even hear as they're swinging on the swing? They hear their father talking about business or talking about whatever. So that's vignette number one. Vignette number two. My wife's an attorney in a large law firm in Manhattan, and they invited her and her, I guess they invited spouses to come to their retreat. And I went to the retreat last year, and I snuck into a session. And what I heard was the following statistic. At first, I didn't believe, so I had to go to the head of the firm to check it out. He told me it was true. The statistic was that the firm received 1 million pieces of email a week. 1 million pieces of email a week. 1 week. 1 week, 1 million pieces of email. So my father heard these two vignettes, and in a speech he gave that we were on the same program, he said, "It's an age of information without knowledge, communication without connection." Think about that. Information without knowledge, communication without connection. And isn't that the opposite of what it takes to bring the soul out of hiding? How does the soul come out? It comes out. Spirituality is nourished around the Shabbos table. It's nourished by just hanging out with your kid with the cell phone off, with the BlackBerry off, without outside information coming in, okay? And I think that's the opening salvo I want to begin with, because I think that in order for us to understand how to nourish spirituality, I know time pressures are real. And I know the time pressures are phenomenally, phenomenally embedded in the stressful lifestyle we all lead. We have to pay. Do they charge for tuition in this town for yeshivas? No, I don't think so. But in communities where they charge for tuition, shul membership, there's no charge, is there? Okay? So we have an expensive lifestyle. We have to keep it fueled. But the reality is that step one in nourishing our children's spirituality is a step back. Take a step back and look at this time factor. Just look at it. Look at it, hold it up to light, and sort of take a step back. There's a beautiful concept I heard from, actually I read in Or Gedaliah, another Rebbe of mine, Gedaliah Shor, was Rosh Yeshiva of Tar V'Das when I was there. He used to send me out to buy him his cigarettes, but it's a whole other story. I wasn't exactly seen as the most promising student there when I was there, I guess. You know, you have a base medrash of 300-400 guys, Pelkovitz, go get me cigarettes. Okay. So it's another era. So in Or Gedaliah, there's this incredible insight. Listen to this insight on time. And it's very topical with Pesach coming up on us. Vayichi, okay? Right? We read it a while ago. But between Vayigash and Vayichi, if you were called up to an aliyah, if you were a Kohen, you were called up to the aliyah Vayichi, you'd see that it's stuma. What stuma means is that usually there's a space between each portion of the Torah. Okay, so between Vayigash and Vayichi, there should be a space. But you don't see a space. There's Vayigash runs into Vayichi, not a single space. The return bar isn't hit on the keyboard. And the question is, and Rashi tells us, why is there no space? Because it's shorthand for the meaning of slavery. Vayichi begins the story of us being enslaved. And what we're told is symbolically, it's to tell us that there was no time. When you become a slave, you have no time. When you become a slave, there's no pause to breathe. There's no pause, okay? What's the big difference between being a slave and being a free person? That's what the Seder is about. The Seder is about we own our time. We own our time. Exactly. That's the key. That's the key. That's the season we're in. It's the season of recognizing that the key to freedom is the space to breathe and to decide. That's what this weekend is about. Is we have a chance to take a step back and look. Shor goes on to say, look at Parsha Shira. Parsha Shira, where you have the song of redemption. Okay, the song, music is the space to expand. I experienced that in a very powerful way this week. Okay? There's a lot of songs going on. We were met at the airports as we're helping free this kid. And people join us in song. Parsha Shira, Rabbi Shor points out, is totally patuach. It's totally opened up. You take a look at a Torah, there's a large space setting off the song of redemption and freedom on both ends. Because it symbolizes the pause to breathe in this space. Let me tell you another quick vignette. No, a vignette, I don't have to be fast. I'll tell you another vignette, okay? A slow vignette. And I don't even know if it's appropriate to do it, but it's okay. I'm from out of town, okay? So it goes like this. See, that's the way to get people's attention. I'm about to tell an inappropriate story. But it's a true story. It's a true story. As opposed to all the other ones I've told you. And it goes like this. There's a couple that comes to see me. They're having bad marital problems. I only saw them once. Second session, the woman comes in and this is probably the most unbelievable story I'm going to tell you all weekend. But when I think about it, I can't believe it. Okay, and it's not that unbelievable. It's just amazing. Okay, so she comes in, and she and her husband sit down, and she takes out an album of pictures, and she thrusts them on her husband's lap. What the pictures were, she had hired a detective to follow her husband. And the detective had pictures of the husband caught in the act of infidelity. Can't argue, right? It's there. She shows and she sees, and he's obviously totally, totally taken aback. She wanted to wait for the safety of the therapist's office to tell him. And she says, look what's happened. You think I don't know? Look! So there's a pause. Okay, I figure it's time now to, let's get to work. This is, Sometimes it could be the beginning of a new honesty and a new openness and even closer to marriage. Sometimes not. But I get ready. Okay, I have my job cut out for me. And as I'm about to intervene and start to figure out where to go, her cell phone rings. And she takes the call. She takes the call. And to me, it's like watching a train wreck in slow motion. I usually would have stopped it, but I was truly, I don't get speechless very easily, I was speechless. Because she takes the call, I figure, oh my God, who died? You know, she said, what, are her children okay? She says, hello, and it's a friend. And she starts talking to the friend, and for about 5 minutes, she doesn't say, I'll call you back. Is it something important? No, they're just chatting. And she then, and her husband is like looking and I'm looking. She shuts the phone down, puts it and says, where was I? And she starts to cry. Now, in defense, in defense of her, I'm sure she was in shock. I'm sure she wasn't thinking. But again, what it taught me was how it's not thinking. There's no pause to breathe. The way this stuff has taken over our lives, Levy saw me. I was probably getting very nervous because I was getting bombarded. I don't even know. The last time I heard, I think I have 300 messages. I have a special service that allows me to have messages. You just can't. You have to make a choice, and I do my best to get back, and there are all these things. But the reality is you have a choice to either live life or to be the slaves of time, be the slaves of demands. You either have that space, the space that sets off the Shira, the symbolism of freedom, or we have the stuma, the closed lack of freedom that our society hit. We have information without knowledge, communication without connection. That's spirituality. It's the essence of spirituality. Research shows this. You look at what differentiates families that transmit religious values effectively and families that don't. One of the most powerful predictors is this time component. As a matter of fact, it's a beautiful thought. Again, I heard this from my father. And the thought goes like this. And with this, I'll end the time section. The thought is, it says, the Kutzker. Kutzker was a brilliant Hasidic master, who fascinating figure, who had incisive, incredible insights into human nature. And there's a passage at the end of Tehillim that says, Kachitzim biyad gibar kein b'nei hana'urim, which basically means it's talking about raising children, educating children, and it compares the process to being an archer. So the Kutzker asks, what's the connection between being an archer and raising children? It doesn't make any sense. And he answers that just like an archer, the closer you hold the bow to your heart, the further and straighter the arrow goes. So too with raising our children, the closer we hold them to our heart, the further and straighter they go. Okay? Part one is finished. Okay, that's time. Take home message, just spend time. And you know what? Even if you're not spending time, figure out a way to steal the time. Figure it out a way. You know, I was away. Sometimes I'm away for Shabbos. So I was away, and my wife told me she was home alone. Well, I knew she was home alone. I'm not that out of touch. She was home alone. She often travels with me, but she was home alone with my youngest child, a wonderful kid. Some people here know her. They went on Jolt with her this summer. A bunch of kids were. She spent a lot of time with the St. Louis kids. So my youngest daughter, who's a senior in high school in New York, and my wife had, usually we have a lot of company, we have a lot going on in our house, but my wife decided, let's just have, it was a unique opportunity to have time alone, just she and my daughter spend Friday night meal together. She told me it went on for something like 5-6 hours. Totally, they were just sort of like kicking back, totally free. The beauty of Friday night, the beauty of Shabbos is we're forced to shut down the phone. We're forced to shut off the BlackBerry. So what happened? She told me that just the level of communication between them. She's a great kid. She's easy to communicate with. But she started with that time and the lack of interruption and nobody else being around, there was a level of communication that was unparalleled between them. My daughter told me about it when I came home. She said, wow, we really talked. You know, and she's a communicator anyway, but it went to deeper and deeper levels. That could only happen if we have that space set up. Okay. Now, part two. Part two is interesting. I never used to talk about this, but it came out of my computer. So I'll tell you this little interesting situation that came up a couple of months ago. We started a study at YU last May where we wanted to understand the experience of spending the year in Israel. So now that I'm at YU, I've been there, it's my fourth year, I figure let's get some, there isn't that much research informing our way of life. So one of my goals as I switched from the secular to the more religious community in terms of focus of research was let's try to understand what predicts various trajectories when our kids leave home to go off to Israel. And we looked at a group of, pretty intensively, a group of 230 seniors. We're now actually bringing the study to various yeshivot out of the New York area. And happy to include you guys. We could always talk about how to do that. But it's basically, we threw about 30 variables at the kids at the end of their senior year of their yeshiva high school. And then we're following them, God willing, I'm going Erev Lag BaOmer to Israel to hunt these 230 kids down. And we're going to see what predicts satisfaction with religious change. And we looked intensively at all these variables. Family functioning, how much family conflict is there, relationship with teachers, relationship with sort of self-concept, psychological factors. And we throw all of this, and I was taking this kind of empirical approach using, you know, very respected, reliable, and valid measures. And, you know, there's always something nice. The most exciting part, research sounds boring. It's really not boring, because the exciting part is when you sit down with your statistician and you finally have everything, all the data in the computer in a clean way, and then you press the button and you start to see, okay, what does predict religious actions and religious beliefs? What predicts spirituality? We have all kinds of interesting ways of measuring it. I won't bore you with the details. And we press the button, and what comes out is number one was something I'd forgotten we had even measured. I didn't even know we measured it. And I look at it, I think, well, maybe something's broken. Press it. There, number one. Most, you know what number one was? Number one was a sense of optimism about God, a focus on the positive aspects of the religion. And I thought, what does this mean? And I thought, oh my God, you know, all this time, all this money, we had wonderful support from YU in doing the study, and this is what comes out. A lot of other stuff came out. The stuff we'd expect, family, the stuff I'm organizing this talk around comes from that group of things, including everything we're talking about, the study kind of confirms. But number one is optimism. So sort of one of the things we measured is in times of stress, do you turn to God in a positive way? Or is it basically, is it midas hadin or midas harachamim that you're relating to? And it turns out, relating to the ahava dimension of our connection of bein adam l'makom, the love dimension is what predicts this. And I started thinking about it, it made a lot of sense. And it reminded me, first of all, Moshe Feinstein used to say brilliantly, he used to say that, you know, one of the most spiritually alienating things going on in the first generation here after the Holocaust was the phrase, it's schwer zu sein yid. You know, be men coming home from grueling work weeks, they'd sit down and they'd crash and they'd be forced to not work on Shabbos and often lose their jobs because of it. And they'd say, oh, it's so hard to be Jewish. So hard to be Jewish. And that negativity turned kids off. There was a family I spoke to a couple of years back whose kid was becoming a little marginalized, a little bit at risk. And they're sort of desperate. They didn't quite know what to do with him. And they snuck him into NCSY Kollel. Back at a time that NCSY Kollel, I think, was in Israel, where there was tremendous focus on just Jewish thinking and on really talking about some of the basics of belief. And the kid comes back and he's transformed. And they're amazed. They didn't expect him to be really impacted by the program. They just wanted him off the streets. They wanted him to be the OU's problem, not their problem for the summer. So the kid comes back, and he's transformed. He stays transformed. And they ask him, what's going on? He said, look, he said, until you sent me away, he said, my view of God was the God of the nose. Don't do this on Shabbos. Don't do that. You're not allowed to do this. You're not allowed to think about that. You're not allowed to talk to girls. You're not allowed to do this. He said, I didn't know, though, who Hashem was. It was only there that I, for the first time, understood what this is about. They taught me who Hashem was. They taught me about the love. They taught me about the positive parts of what the religion's about. And once he had that, he connected. That's what came out of the computer. Let me tell you a story. I sometimes do interesting things in my life. I don't quite know how it happened, but lately I get pulled into some interesting stuff. So this was one of the more, it was just odd. I was asked to spend a couple of days in Bournemouth, England, at the invitation of the Chief Rabbi Sachs's office, to be the scholar in residence for the rabbis of the UK. And by the way, you haven't lived till you've seen rabbinic cricket. On the schedule, they have something called rabbinic cricket. It's an amazing experience. You go outside onto the lawn there in Bournemouth. It's overlooking the water off the Isle of Wight. And you have these rabbis, full suits, and they're playing cricket. And it's called rabbinic cricket. It's wonderful. You know, I think there could be some kind of reality TV series, you know, based on that. So if anybody has that idea, you're welcome to run with it. I just want a little credit on the bottom, okay? We've been at crickets. Right, that's right. I like that. So, rabbinic cricket, okay. So I gave a series of talks there, and Rabbi Sachs sat in the front row, and he took notes. And at the end of every talk, he would give me feedback, brilliant feedback, a list of books to read. It was unbelievable. It was very positive. It was like, he's a brilliant man. So I gave a talk where I must have touched on optimism. I don't usually talk about it, but he told me the following story, which is unbelievable to me, and very much in keeping with the election year. He said that there was, you know, he's very connected to the political process in England. He's close to the Queen. He's close to the Prime Minister. He wouldn't tell me who this story was about, but it's an amazing story. He said that somebody was running for high office in England, and he figured that a good way to get votes, and he was ahead in the polls initially, but a good way to get votes was to pander to the Arab interests there. So it was a very anti-Israel and subtly anti-Semitic platform he was running on. And he wasn't doing that great in the polls, but still, he figures, how else can you get votes? But, you know, why not get the Muslim votes? A big, big voting bloc in the UK. And Rabbi Sachs, of course, was very upset. And he calls this candidate up and says, can I meet with you? And the candidate says, look, Rabbi, all due respect, you have nothing to tell me. I don't want to hear anything. You're not going to change my mind on the Middle East issue. And frankly, I really don't even want to let you in my office. No. So Rabbi Sachs says, look, I'll make you a deal. I'll cut you a deal. The word Jew will not pass my lip. The word Israel will not pass my lips. I'm just coming to give you political advice. I promise good political advice. I give you my word. So the candidate isn't doing as well as he was supposed to be doing. He said, okay, but you let out one thing about the Middle East situation, you're out of my office. So Sir Sachs goes, and he sits down in the man's office, and he tells him one thing. He tells him a study done by Dr. Martin Seligman. Actually, I got my doctor from Penn, University of Pennsylvania, where Dr. Seligman is the head of the program. Dr. Seligman's main area is then called positive psychology, trying to understand happiness, optimism, gratitude, forgiveness, fascinating stuff. It's a whole sea change in the focus of psychology just in the last 5-10 years. And what Dr. Seligman did was he did something very simple. He had his graduate students take the transcripts of the victory speech for the last 100 years of the Republican victor of the presidential nomination and the Democratic victor. Stripped it of its identifiers. You didn't know whose speech it was. And he asked his graduate students, just rate it for optimism versus pessimism. Every time you see a positive comment, give it an optimism point. Every time you see a negative comment, a pessimism point. And it turned out that the level of optimism predicted who would be elected president at a far stronger level than any poll did. It was much more predictive than the polls. The ability to talk, I think that's partly why Obama is doing so well, he conveys optimism. In a way that's not, don't worry, I will not touch the politics, trust me. Although Hillary Clinton was incredibly helpful to us this week. She was unbelievable in getting this kid out. Okay, nobody knows what I'm talking about. Many people don't know what I'm talking about, but that's another talk. Okay, so that's the optimism piece. So let me summarize this piece. And it's not. I spoke last night to the educators. Huh? Oh, I always forget to say that. Thank you, Rabbi. Yeah. Now this gets a little complicated. He changed the focus and stopped attacking the Jews and the and supporting the Arabs in his campaign, and he won the election. After that, you know, Dr. Seligman's a good psychologist, and Sir Rabbi Sachs, Rabbi Dr. Sachs, I never know what to call him. I just call him Rabbi. But he didn't tell me who it was. But it was obviously some high-level national guy. You probably could figure it out by, you know, doing some basics. Probably not that hard to figure out who was running that way, who shifted. But he would not tell me who it was. But he won the election. May not have been so good he won the election, but he won the election. Okay. So last night I was talking about the attitude of joy. Anybody was there last night other than Levi and the rabbi? Who else? Okay, so I don't want to repeat myself. But basically I was talking about the attitude of joy. How joy and happiness and focusing on the positive in the religion conveys spirituality. It's besimcha. Ivdu is Hashem besimcha, right? You connect to Hashem through the joy. You know, it's, there's beautiful Rambam on Hilchos Yontif, right? And he says there are two ways you could approach happiness on a holiday like Pesach. He said you could sit down and put a focus on the material enjoyment. And he calls that simchas kreso, the happiness of the stomach, okay? Or he says you could sit down and use the holiday to invite, his lashon is umlole nefesh v'davone lev, people who are alone, people who are depressed, people who are forlorn, okay? You could reach out to them. And he says, that is simcha shel mitzvah. That's what happiness is. And simchas kreso is elusive and is not what we're talking about in terms of what we need to do on a holiday like Pesach. It's a brilliant insight. And that's the attitude of joy. But joy conveyed with the connection to the spiritual is a very powerful kind of factor in terms of turning kids on. I teach in a graduate school of Jewish education. That's one of the hats I wear. And I often go around my classes at the beginning of the semester and I ask them, what turned you on to Jewish education? Because there's some wonderful educators. I'm very optimistic about the new generation of educators as being, there's some people who could easily have gone to law school or to medical school and are choosing to focus on a somewhat less lucrative way of life, okay? And I go around and I ask them, what turned you on to this? And invariably, it's not the content, not almost invariably, very often it is the content, but it's the content mixed with its relationship with a mentor, relationship with an inspiring teacher. Then when I ask them, but what was it about the teacher that you love? What was it about the Rebbe or about the Mechanechet that you fell in love with? And invariably, it's the joy and enthusiasm with which they embraced our religion. When you get right down to it, I'd say that's 90% of the time an ingredient in turning them on to living an idealistic life as a Jewish educator. Okay, so that's part two, optimism. Part three is perhaps one of the more important parts, and that's the part of modeling. You know, you want to know how your children are going to daven one day? Look at how you daven. You want to know how your children are going to, how charitable they are? A lot of research shows, just look at how charitable you are. You want to know how involved they're going to be in the community? Look at how involved are you with the community. It's a straight line, straight line. We don't even know it. There's an image burned in my mind from this last Yom Kippur. I almost wished I had a video, and I don't lose my cool easily, and nobody even knew this. I was silently seething, but it got to me. There was a person, a group of people sitting in the front of the shul I was davening at, and there was this incredible image. There was two men talking to each other, I'm sure about business, during Unisana Tokef and Kedusha on Yom Kippur. Talking. Right, the holy, come on, how depraved can you be? So they're talking to each other during the holiest part of the holiest service of the Jewish year. And right behind them, this is where I wanted the video camera, right behind them were their two teenage sons of each of the guys talking to each other. It was like you saw the generations going. You just saw it. And on the other side of the shul, there were people davening with kavana and really focused. And what was happening? The father is davening, and his sons sitting next to him are davening with equal hislavos, with equal passion. It's a little obvious point, but it's so true. It's so true. We don't even realize how we model for our children. There's no Kiddush club here, is there? Well, you guys are just so well behaved here in St. Louis, okay? What do you do for fun? What do you do? Okay. Okay, what do you do to rebel? Come on, it's got to be something. Okay. So you all know what a Kiddush club, though, is? Okay. So there's this great story that Rabbi Kripke told me, who now is a Turo, used to be at the OU, was one of the high-ranking officials of the OU. A number of years back, the OU banned Kiddush clubs. So for those of you who don't know, it's this wonderful Jewish religious ritual where during the Haftorah, as the Navi is brought out and the Balmafter is reading the Haftarah, a select group of men, only men. By the way, if you want to ruin a Kiddush club, open it up to women. It's gone within a week. Little trick I teach some rabbis sometimes. So anyway, they go out and they have the finest single malt scotch and they come back totally drunk for the rabbi's speech. Okay? It's an interesting, it's a phenomenally interesting little ritual. It's taken hold in parts of Israel now, and it's there in a lot of parts of the country. So the OU was concerned about the modeling effect on kids, and they were worried about kids and a growing alcohol and drug problem in among our teens in different communities. And they said, let's ban the Kiddush club. They come up with a statement that any OU-affiliated shul has to stop having a Kiddush club. There's no teeth to it. It's more of a moral message. And rabbis around the country, you know, announced that the Kiddush club is closed. Which my father, who was a seasoned rabbi, said in his shul, where they have a very serious Kiddush club, they even own a building nearby and they cater it. It's a whole thing. So, it's unbelievable. He said, he's tried different things. He said, ultimately, he decided to say it's not allowed because he says, he knows it's not going to stop them. He says they have so much more fun when it's usser, you know, when they think that they're, he says, little trick, you know. So he says, no, you shouldn't do it. And then he looks the other way. That was, before he was Zemaritis. So anyway, he says the toughest thing about retirement now is that he misses the vacations. Anyway, so Monday morning, Rabbi Kripke, the Monday morning after the ban, Rabbi Kripke comes to, I have to start behaving myself and focusing, but we're okay with time. So Rabbi Kripke gets back to his office Monday morning, and immediately there's a furious phone call from the president of a very large OU-affiliated shul. And the president says to him, "Rabbi Krupka, how much pleasure do Jewish men have in their lives? We work like dogs. We don't really have much time to enjoy ourselves. So for 10 crummy minutes a week, we kick back and enjoy ourselves, and you want to take that away from us?" And he's screaming and yelling. Rabbi Krupka says, "Look, we have to do it for the sake of our children." And the president, like, angrily hangs up the phone on him. 2 weeks later, he gets the following apologetic phone call, Rabbi Krupka, from this president. He comes into the office. There's a message waiting from the president, the same man. He says, "Rabbi, I have to call you to apologize." He said, "Last night, I took my 15-year-old son to Madison Square Garden to watch the Knicks play. And there was a group of older teenagers in a row in front of us getting drunk out of their minds on beer. And they're like making fools of themselves. So I figure it's a teachable moment for my son." And I turn to my son and I say, see what happens when you get out of control with drinking?" And this kid looks at him and he says, "Yeah, that's exactly the way you and your friends look when you come back from Kiddush Club every Shabbos." Okay? Now, you know, sometimes there's a smart kid and smart, but you know what? I talked about the neurosurgeon study last night. The neurosurgeon study, and for those of you who weren't there, and it was only a handful of you who were there, it says that the ability to acknowledge your mistakes is the difference between greatness and mediocrity. The ability to take a step back. So what differentiates the top 1% of neurosurgeons from the top 1% in this fascinating study was, how do you handle your mistakes? And the ability, so the man said, "You know something, Rabbi Krupka, you're right. It's the end of our Kiddush Club." Okay? So there's that modeling part. And I want to read to you two thoughts on modeling in terms of the power of parental influence in a positive way in terms of shaping spiritual beliefs. And one is Shmuel's coat. I don't know how many of you know about Shmuel's coat. It's related in a way to yesterday's parsha. It's an unbelievable story that Rav Chaim Shmuel Levitz talks about. Shmuel, the great prophet, okay, born after tremendous struggle with infertility on the part of his mother, on the part of Hannah. Listen to what the Medrash tells us about Shmuel's coat. It says, "Umeil katan teyaselo." His mother wove this beautiful coat for Shmuel. And it says in the Medrash, when he was a baby, it was ready for him when he was born. And it says in the Medrash, okay, "Bo godal, bo nikvar, bo ola." What does that mean? In that coat, he was raised, and it grew with him. And in that coat, he was buried. And then when the witch of Ender summons him back from the world to come, because his counsel is needed, he comes back from Olam Haba, wearing, the Medrash tells us, the mother's coat. So Rav Chaim Shmuel Levitz has this unbelievable insight. He asks a simple question. He says, we know from the Medrash that Moshe demanded that people come to him. And thus, he had to walk to the burning bush to come closer to Hashem. Shmuel, on the other hand, went to the people. He had the love to go to the people. And thus, he had the schus of having Hashem come to him. So Rav Chaim Shmuel Levitz asks, what was the secret of Shmuel? That he had the love to go to the people. He was there for the people. And he says, it was the coat. It was the coat. It was the coat that was woven with incredible love and tears by his mother as she was expecting him. Okay, he goes on to write, he says that Hannah weaned Shmuel at 2 years of age, brought him to Eli, and as she departed, all she left behind for him to be raised was the small coat that she had made. And he goes on to write that every fiber of this Me'il, Every fiber of this special garment was infused with the yearning, aspirations, hopes, and dreams that Chana had for Shmuel. It was woven with love. It was woven with love. It was infused with her tears and infused with her love. And that power transcended the grave. That power made him at one level have spiritual powers that were beyond the greatest of all Nevi'im. It's an amazing, amazing concept. The love of a mother for a child as a method of transmission of spirituality. Listen to this. It's one of the most beautiful statements I've ever read. Many of us have heard this from the Rav, from Rav Soloveitchik. He gave this at the Hesped for the Rebbetzin of Talna. Right? Some of you have heard this, but every time I read it, chills run up my spine on the same topic. And here's what the Rav said, what Rav Soloveitchik said. He said, I used to have long conversations with my mother. In fact, it was a monologue rather than a dialogue. She talked, and I happened to overhear. She talked, Me'inyono Diyoma. Relevant topics having to do with the holiday or the day. I used to watch her arranging the house in honor of a holiday. I used to see her recite her prayers. I used to watch her recite the Sedra every Friday night. Most of all, I learned that Judaism expressed itself not only in formal compliance with the law, but also in a living experience. She taught me that there's a flavor, a scent, a warmth to mitzvot. I learned from her the most important thing in life, to feel the presence of the Almighty and the gentle pressure of His hand resting upon my frail shoulders. Without her teachings, which quite often were transmitted to me in silence, I would have grown up a soulless being, dry and insensitive. The fathers knew much about the Shabbos. The mothers lived the Shabbos, experienced her presence, and perceived her beauty and splendor. That's the essence of transmission of spirituality. It's the smell, it's the aroma, it's the nonverbal transmission through children seeing what we live. It's not just the cognitive, which he says is uniquely often a father's role. Shema b'ni musar avicha. Fathers, psychology research doesn't quite understand it. There seems to be a unique role of fathers in moral transmission throughout the world in the longitudinal studies of transmission of values to children and religious values to children. Actively present fathers do the cognitive. Of course it's mixed, but mothers are about the smell. They're about the warmth. They're about the frail hand on your shoulder silently teaching you what religion is all about. So that's that part, okay? So far we talked about the role of time, we talked about the role of optimism, and we talked about the all-important role of modeling. And let me end. There's so many directions I could get this. I teach a course on this at YU. And I could get you going. We could go in a million different directions. But I think it's better to get some discussion going. So let me end. I'm going to end with the Tolstoy short story. Okay? I'm probably belaboring the point. But to me, this is what matters most. Our kids learn from teachers. By the way, three top ingredients come out of a computer. Number one, positivity. Number two, obviously, the role of parents. This thing. It's the love, the coat of Shmuel is number two. The frail hand of the Rav's mother resting on his shoulder, on his frail shoulders, the strong hand resting on his frail shoulders. And number three, of course, was extra familial, the mentors, the teachers, the Rebbeim, the Mechanechet, people practicing what they preach, people infusing the children with the love of Torah and a love of mitzvot. And when children are surrounded with that love and that warmth, that's when they absorb spirituality. I'm going to end with a Tolstoy short story. Usually it's probably what happens. Okay? Have you ever had a Tolstoy short story? I think it's something we can learn from everybody. Okay. And here it goes. Probably a stupid way to end, but okay. The grandfather had become very old, and his legs wouldn't go, his eyes didn't see, his ears didn't hear. He had no teeth, and when he ate, the food dripped from his mouth. The son and daughter-in-law stopped setting a place for him at the table and gave him supper in back of the stove. Once, they brought dinner down to him in a cup. The old man wanted to move the cup and dropped and broke it. The daughter-in-law began to grumble at the old man for spoiling everything in the house and breaking the cups and said that she would now give him dinner in a dishpan. The old man only sighed and said nothing. Once the husband and wife were staying at home and watching their small son playing on the floor with some wooden planks, he was building something. The father asked, "What is it that you're doing, Misha?" And Misha said, "Dear father, I'm making a dishpan so that when you and dear mother become old, you may be fed from this dishpan." The husband and wife looked at one another and began to weep. They became ashamed of so offending the old man, and from then on seated him at the table and waited on him. So that's the essence of what I'm talking about. The essence of what I'm talking about is both Botova, on the one hand, the coat woven with love, Lura, in terms of all the indirect ways. Look, what's the most important? There's nothing quite as important in our lives as raising our children. So life's work. There's the Hebrew word ahava. In gematria, the numerical equivalent of the word love is identical to the numerical equivalent of the word da'aga, worry. And isn't that true? Worry and love are inextricably intertwined, right? That's what it's about. You know, I spoke about the negative story of Yom Kippur. I don't want to end on negativity, so I'll end perhaps with a positive thought. Going back to the holiday season. And it's a wonderful thought. It used to be shared by the old-style Magidim in Europe at Ne'ilah. I don't know how many of you noticed. If you use an art scroll sitter, it's machzer, it's been brought back. And it was in the old style. The machzer I grew up with had this. What was it called again? Orli Yisrael machzers with a Yiddish translation on the side. I got it for my bar mitzvah or something. Never understood it, but it had this following thing. It's the holiest time of the Jewish year, Kaddish, okay? Same Kaddish I was talking about Lura a few minutes ago. And there's an incredible psychological test. I don't know how many of you noticed. There's a psychological test every Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. An unbelievable psychological test. The Chazan, in the repetition of the Shemona Esrei on Yom Kippur and on Rosh Hashanah, but on Yom Kippur, especially Musaf, there's an asterisk next to the word Ayeh. We're saying, where is the place of Hashem's splendor? And you have a chance, if the Chazan is being Marech and Ayeh, okay? You have a chance to choose one of three special tefillot. You only have time for one. It's a wonderful multiple choice psychological test. So you go down, and you could choose now, at this special point of divine receptiveness. Here's your choice. Some of you may remember. Choice one, Osher Muflug. Okay? You could daven for unbelievable wealth. That's what I spoke about Friday night. Osher Muflug. Okay? Or, I can understand going for Osher Muflug. Why not? Go for the lottery. Osher Muflug. Choice two, Ruach HaKodesh, special divine inspiration and divine gifts. Choice three, the asterisk goes down to a brief Yehi Ratzon, where you could briefly pray for Banim Tovim Umuhuganim, for fine and proper children. And the old Sal Magidim and Ne'ilah, the gates are closing and our fate for the year is being chosen. would turn to everybody and say, look, I know which Yehi Ratzon each of you picked. What Jewish parent would not pick the Yehi Ratzon for Banim Tovim Muhuganim? Ava Daiga, right? And they'd say, so in that schus of us making the right choice, in that schus, may we all go on to have a wonderful year. So thank you, everybody, and let's get some discussion going. Yes?
I'm hoping you'll come up with a story or a comment about three important factors: parent, teacher, and positivity, but they interact in one way. One particular detail is the relationship that parents model how to relate to teachers or to schools, and to do it in a positive way. I see often children who are sort of caught wanting to develop a relationship with a teacher, but sometimes not so easy. What they pick up at home is either questions or just general negativity, or unfortunately teachers can be a little to this left, a little to right, a little to senior. And there's, I'm not sure everybody's quite aware of the bind the children are put in.
It's an excellent question. It's a universal question. There isn't a parent or teacher that hasn't struggled with the question. Let me repeat it. The question is, how do we deal with the disconnect sometimes between what's going on at school and what's going on at home? What happens if a teacher is educating a child in one direction and you feel that you're not happy with what's going on in the other direction? How do you deal with that? And how do you deal with that in a way that isn't giving the children an inconsistent message that totally subverts what we're talking about here? And the simple answer is what I talked about earlier this weekend, which is the importance of focusing on the positive and being very careful about not exposing kids to negative messages. So what you have to do, I believe, is, okay, look, you have to be there for your kid and you have to support your kid and you have to do what you believe is right, but never at the cost of exposing the child to any kind of active disparagement of the teacher. I spoke about some of the research, one of the talks, I forgot when, about the importance of perspective taking. That in longitudinal studies on what gives birth to empathy and menschlichkeit in children, a key ingredient is how is it that parents and teachers deal with perspectives of those with whom they disagree? And it turns out that respect for the perspective of others is one of the core ingredients, along with time and along with the balance disciplinary style. Those are the three factors that are most predictive of whether our children internalize our religious and moral values. And that's very important. So it's very important is that I can understand there are times that there's tremendous disagreement with either a philosophy of a school or tremendous disagreement with a treatment by a particular teacher of your child. And that's what really calls for a tremendous amount of discipline. Because the way you handle that, and there's a way to handle it with completely supporting your child and completely, though, also not exposing them to confusing mixed messages. So the focus needs to be on the positive. I know that doesn't give you a formula, but if I tried to give you a formula, I'd be lying. But thank you. It's an excellent point. Yes?
Well, this is a great lecture.
Thank you
so much. I took notes, and I have a list of books for you to read.
Okay. Can we play rabbinic cricket afterwards? Yeah. What was that?
Said, don't flatter yourself.
His name is Joseph Scott, so it's okay.
Oh, so you're really a lad. Oh, I didn't know that. Okay.
We're working on a connection.
Your name is really Jonathan Sachs?
No,
Joseph Strauss.
Joe Strauss.
It's the same initials.
Oh, wow. Oh, then I have to try. I'll listen to whatever you have to say. Go ahead. There, by the way, they have to be. I've become friendly with the family. They have to be a wonderful family, so I'll particularly listen to you, just in case you're related. Yeah. Yeah.
Is there a point at which, in the education of a kid, a child, that it's too late? that you kind of missed the boat. If you have not, you know, dotted the I's and crossed the T's on all the things that you talked about, is there a point at which it's like, you know, forget it?
Yeah, excellent question. And let me answer with Israel. I'll repeat the question. The question is there a point that it's too late? Is there a point that it's too late? And that if you sort of like it's the critical period question. There are critical periods of development that if you pass a certain critical period and you don't see, for example, oh, I forgot a quarter of my speech and my best story that I was saving all weekend. Oh, okay. Okay, that's my chance. Let me answer your question with a story, and then I have to do my other part. Okay, so I'm telling you, you're going to feel great when you hear this story. It's a new story. Nobody's heard it here. Nobody's heard it. It's a great story because it just happened. Okay, so and I've been saving it, and then I forgot. I would have been so upset. Okay, because it's the bet you'll leave floating when you hear this story. It's a great story. It's true. So let me go back to your question, because it's an excellent question, and it's the sleeper effect. And what you have to understand is it's never too late. It's never too late. And in fact, though, you often don't know till later. You don't know till later, because there's the sleeper effect. So let me tell you a story, and it just shows the complexity of this. I have some good friends, happens to be Rabbi of a shul in the New York metropolitan area, and he and his wife came over to our house for a barbecue last summer. And they had wonderful parents, but they sometimes got into power struggles with some of their kids. Wonderful kids also. And they had one kid who must have been tactile sensitive, and he hated wearing his tzitzis. He hated the feeling. It just cut through him like a knife. So they had an ongoing battle throughout the kid's childhood, where every morning he'd run off to school, he wasn't wearing the tzitzis, the mother and father would hold him down, they put the tzitzis, it was like ridiculous, okay? Until finally the kid got smart, and throughout high school, they found out later on, he'd run out with tzitzis, they thought, oh, thank God, he's reflecting our dreams. And what he did was, is he had a little box in the front of the lawn. When the school bus would come, he became expert at quickly ditching the tzitzis, putting it in the box, you know, and covering it over with leaves and twigs, and then when he came home, he'd take it out. Okay, but basically, he never caught the tzitzis habit, okay? Which is a big thing. This is a family whose bumper sticker was, you know, really, you know, very religious family. And it really drove them nuts. But they gave up. At a certain point, you have to give up. Critical period passed. So when we had our friends over for the barbecue, the father said, I have a great story for you. He said, earlier that day, this son, who's now a father, called them up. And he said, Abba, you're going to love this story. He said, his three-year-old son came home from preschool. And he's all excited. And he says, Abba, Abba, I learned how to make a bracha on tzitzis today. Quick, take out your tzitzis. I want to show you the bracha. He wasn't wearing tzitzis. He hadn't worn tzitzis since he took it out of the box on the last day of his senior year of high school. Okay? So now the shock of recognition hit him. Now he realized he's playing for keeps. And he runs to the phone. He calls his father and he says, Abba, another day will not pass without me wearing tzitzis. It's a beautiful. And that, I could give you many other examples. There's a sleep effect. Never give up. As long as it's coming from love. As long as it's coming from love without pushing too much. Just love and expectation. And I think there's no critical period that passes. And ultimately, you never know the end until then. You just don't know. You don't know. Okay? I went from being the cigarette getter for Gedalia Shore to quoting him in St. Louis, you know? I don't know. So he would have been quite shocked. Anyway, so let me tell you the part that I missed. And I think it's an important part. As an igniter of spirituality, it's the power of chesed. The power of chesed and what psychologists call required helpfulness. So what the research shows is, especially when you have kids who aren't that tied into content, and they're not destined to be turned on by the content of learning Torah or Nevi'im or Ksuvim or Gemara, but you could connect them to required helplessness. There's an island off one of the Hawaiian islands, Kauai, They studied every child born in this very impoverished area that had a lot of abuse and a lot of poverty from 1955 up into adulthood, and they looked what predicted resilience. So you won't be surprised from everything I've been talking about this weekend that, you know, a third were resilient, a third in the middle, a third succumbed to the ravages of poverty and abuse. And they're still following these people who are now in their mid-50s. And what they found was that, you know, the predictors of resilience were, one was one person who cares. One person, it could have been a teacher, it could have been a friend, it could have been a neighbor, or it could have been an extended family member, one person who cares. The other was active religious faith. Active religious faith, I talked about it last night at Shal Shudas, Kanesha Yarkino, jumping on the back of the eagle I talked about, right? Active religious faith. But number three was something called required helpfulness. I talked about this also last night at Shal Shudas, being required to pitch in. I see this often. Sometimes you'll have kids who have totally left the religion, and you pull them into an opportunity to do good. You get them involved in a charity organization, or you get them involved in working with a child with Down syndrome, or working with a child with special needs, and all of a sudden you see them spiritually become alive. It's one of the main connectors. There are many connectors. Sometimes it's music, sometimes there are many spiritual connectors. I didn't really develop that, but to the extent that we give kids choice, it's incredibly powerful. So here's the story. You're probably going to be disappointed, but it's just a great story. And it goes like this. A woman who's quite poor, living in a Hasidic neighborhood in New York, very, you know, living in a high poverty area, and she's herself quite poor. And I become friendly with her through certain. She's very active in certain areas. And she tells me the following story. I think this kind of story could only happen in that kind of a neighborhood where kids are pulled out of themselves and have to pitch in to do good. And there's an incredible lesson here, I think, about spiritual connection. And it goes like this. She has a 9-year-old daughter. 9-year-old daughter is quite shy. And a woman moves in. This is what reminded me of it. Who's blind. Blind from birth, moves in a couple apartment buildings down, and she's totally alone. She doesn't have parents, she doesn't have a family, and the word gets out to the neighborhood that there's this woman who's an Orthodox woman, but living alone, totally isolated, and she's blind. So, of course, the community gathers around her and gets her support. And this woman tells her 9-year-old daughter, she doesn't ask her, she tells her, 2 nights a week you're going to this home and you're reading to this woman. Okay? Not bad. You have to know, it's like the story I told last night at Shal Shudas. Sometimes you just tell kids what they have to do. You get them beyond themselves. It may be more important a spiritual igniter than the four halakim of Shulchan Aruch. It's very important stuff. Maybe not that, but whatever. It's important. So the girl, I don't want to get myself in trouble, you know. It's almost as important as some stuff. It's not that important. Yeah, okay, it's like as important as you know it to be, okay? Okay, and you'll understand it in a way that's right. Okay, so 9-year-old girl goes over, and she reads to the woman twice a week. One day, by the way, good, it helps her overcome her shyness. One day, the woman, as the little girl's getting up to go back home, the woman says, two more years I could see. So the little girl says, what do you mean? She says, a doctor once told me that they now have surgery that could give me sight, could give me my sight back. But I can't afford it yet. In 2 more years, I'll start getting Social Security. When I get Social Security, I think I could save up enough money to have the surgery. They now have the technology. So the little girl hears this. She doesn't say anything. But she grew up in a neighborhood where helpfulness was required. She doesn't tell her mother, doesn't tell anybody. She goes off to her Hasidic yeshiva the next day. And she realizes, I have a blind woman, I could help her. She goes from class to class, doesn't tell anybody. She goes to the front of the class and she says, excuse me everybody, I'm raising money. There's a woman who's blind who can't see. Can you please give me some money? And she comes running back from school that day, straight to the blind woman's house. And she has an envelope with 83 singles. 83 singles. And she tells the woman, I have the money. I have the money. Come, let's go. She takes the woman, and the woman doesn't even know what's happening. And she takes the woman, you know, with her cane, and there's an ophthalmologist, an Orthodox ophthalmologist around the corner. It's an urban area. And they go, and they sit patiently and wait. And the ophthalmologist shows them in, finally says, excuse me, can I help you? And the woman says, oh, you know, I'm poor. She says, I'm blind. I hear that maybe I could be able to see. He gives her an examination. And the doctor says, you're right. There's no reason for you to be blind. I could give you the surgery. And he admits her to the hospital, does the surgery, and she could see now. Mother doesn't know anything. Nobody knows anything. The woman comes out of the hospital. She asks around, where does this little girl live? Somebody guides her to the little girl's house. And she goes to the mother and she says, I could see now. She tells her the whole story. Now the mother didn't know. She didn't know about this. So right away, first of all, she's very proud of her daughter, of course, but she also realizes it didn't cost $83 to have the surgery. Okay? So she goes to the doctor's office. She waits. And she says, I'm this little girl's mother. And I can't afford it now, but I want to make good on our debt. It must have been tens of thousands of dollars. I'll save up. We'll have the community. We'll figure out a way to pay you back, doctor. It shouldn't have to be on your plate, this thing. The doctor laughs. He says, are you kidding? He says, how often do you get to give somebody back their sight? But he tells the mother, there's one favor I want to ask you. And he takes out the tattered envelope with the 83 singles. And he says, can I keep this? He says, since this happened, I'm walking around, and every time I go through a tough time, or every time there's any stress in my day, I just go from my pocket, and I feel that envelope, and it restores my faith in humanity. Okay? So that's a nice way to end the weekend, right? Thank you, everybody, and thank you.
Dr. Selkowitz, on behalf of everybody, I want to thank you.